During the war, when it started in 1939-40, they were not yet, television didn't exist, but radio did exist. But not too many people owned a radio. But they were loudspeakers on the streets, and they were newspapers, printed newspapers. Which means that it was a way how to transfer or convey a message. Later on, a new word was introduced, and it was called propaganda. Words which would convince people or inform people about events which were reformulated or intentionally intentionally oriented in a way which would serve the purpose of convincing people. Are you good? To convince people simply messages which had an intent, which had an intent to convince people or deceive people, to either convey a message or convey a deformed, false, deceitful message. And this way, for example, we saw living in northern Slovakia in the mountains, and the Polish border was a few dozens kilometers away, a few miles from Polish border, and the German army moved through roads they built a few years before with the intent to use it the way they did. We saw German army tanks and trucks and cannons move towards the north, toward Poland. We were practically witnessing how they destroyed or took over 7 villages already. 3 days later, Hitler had a big speech where he announced that some Polish soldiers offended and shot some Germans across the border. He is not going to take it lightly, he is going to retaliate. And he attacked Poland, and they split it between Stalin and Hitler. About half of Poland got to each side. Which means that we saw the way, we were eyewitnesses of a deceit, how news were telling 3 days after they attacked that they were going to retaliate, and then they attacked already prepared because they made a deal with Stalin, between Stalin and Hitler made a deal. Which means that we did not trust them. In 1925, my parents lived in Middle East, what is now Israel, and they tried to relocate the families to the time it was called Holy Land, because my grandparents were convinced that in Europe, life for Jews in Europe will not end up well. It was also a fortune teller who made his living by telling people's future in the house of my mother's parents. You know, they were renting the back part of their house. And he was telling them that they will end up in fire. Nobody knew how come, because, and they were making fun of his abilities, because one morning when about 20 people gathered in front of his gate, he found a sign saying for sickness closed, I don't work today of sickness. And they say, how come he's able to forecast the future if he didn't know he would get sick? Invited people, and so on, which means that my childhood was full of stories like that. And eventually it was true that they ended up fire, either being killed before or being shot and or poisoned and whatever, but it ended up in a pile of bodies in Opole, my grandfather, or in Auschwitz, which were special crematoria built by Siemens for that purpose, which means that it was not a secret or something. People didn't believe that factory-style murder could take place in that time and age. Psychologists prepared German psychologists, they had a lot of hundreds of PhDs who worked on deceiving populations. They didn't only targeted Jews. Jews were the first one. It was some kind of a test run against people. About 2% of the population of Europe was Jewish. But they had plans to wipe out Slavic people, and their first target, as Mein Kampf book of Adolf Hitler came out in 1925, openly said that he would destroy, kill, wipe out, whatever his using German expressions, ausrotten, like annihilate Polish people and replace them with German race people, the German population, and the same with the Soviet Union, that he would wipe out Slavic people and replace the population with German race, which such a thing didn't exist. All of them were white race, Caucasian we call them now, and it was nothing racial about it. They are races, Oriental races, black, Negroid features, races in Africa, and they were white people with dark hair or light hair or blue eyes or dark brown eyes, but still they were all white people, which means there were three races officially scientifically proven, and there were no racial divisions between black, oriental, or white people. Anyway, in Europe, they replaced the Nuremberg laws came out, and they replaced the race with a religion. Jews looked alike, they were white people, they were the same race, even more often blue-eyed than Germans, and still, that's why they didn't have to distinguish between black and white, because their skin betrayed them. But Jews had to be marked somehow, and they invented those signs. I had to wear, at 11 years old, I had to wear a yellow star 4 inches wide on my chest because I looked even more Aryan, they call it Aryan, than the others. And it was only religion. Definition of Jewish race was to have full Jew was a person who had four Jewish grandparents, which means that parents of your mother, parents of your father had to be all Jewish. But Jewish by religion. Jewish, it was not a race. Because a Catholic or Muslim or Buddhist or a Christian could become Jewish after asking a rabbi to be converted and fulfilling the requirements. Which means that how could somebody be racially different by learning something from books or responding to some requirements which can be intellectually fulfilled. Anyway, Hitler needed to kill Jews and rob them and kill them, and he needed to wipe out Slavic people. This was in his book, Mein Kampf, published in 1925, when my parents lived in the Holy Land. That time it was under British mandate, called British Mandate Palestine, taken over from Turkish Ottoman Empire, who ruled the area for 400 years. My mother knew, and they read that book, and in Palestine they believed it, that this is not a political bluff, this is not a blackmailing requirement. It looks very reliably true. And people in Palestine, Jews particularly, knew that it was not a bluff. It was not a political trick. And my father became very ill. They sent him back to Europe. He was even shot with shotgun wounds. And he had to go to Europe to be treated because there were no medical services yet in that land. That land was very backwards and very primitive. And he had to make a living, became a cantor, and then moved to that part from south Slovakia to the north, to those mountains where I was born, and my siblings, two siblings, were born. Me and my sister, my brothers were born in the city of Trnava, south. Which means my mother knew, was aware very well, what are the intentions and what is it to be expected. Better than anybody else who never left Slovakia for generations, hundreds of years, people lived there. They had their properties, they were assimilated with the environment, they spoke the language. Nobody would believe or trust that something like that could happen, that they would take them and kill them. It was later on, it was leaking out, and during the war, anything can happen. But that time, 1940, 41, even 42, it was unheard. Even politicians in Europe or government leaders, even Roosevelt, Churchill, Stalin, and so on, Pope, who was a so-called moral authority, they would never publicize what they knew. And they knew that it would, when I went to 1940, after finishing my five elementary school grade, I was supposed to continue next grade, and in the fall of 1940, my mother received a letter saying, your children, Jewish children, are not allowed anymore to get education in public schools. You all are not forbidden to enter, to cross the threshold of the public schools. And it was in the fall, in August 1940 already. Before even my birthday. My mother knew that, and my mother said, for good heavens, it's all true, whatever I knew about it or learned about it, it just started. And then we found out, I don't know how, what German psychologists were preparing for Jews to rob gradually, to take away property one after the other, layer after layer, until Jews would not have any money, any jobs. They were not allowed to use warm clothes. In the south it didn't matter so much, but in the north where winters took 10 months of snow on the ground, and on the peaks all year long we could see snow. It was a terrible punishment. But then they came to our apartment, you know, whoever liked a piece of furniture, they took it. And it was, we lost completely legal rights, human rights. Nuremberg laws came out of 1943. This was happening 1940-41. In 41, 270 laws were issued in Slovakia, which were even harsher than Nuremberg laws. But what happened in Germany for 7 years happened in Slovakia in a few weeks or months. It was every week a shock. We had to bring to the police station musical instruments, typing equipment, radios, even paper and pencils, fur, any fur, any jewelry, until practically our apartment became empty. And naturally, lawyers, whoever worked for government, was deprived of the job, was kicked out. they were not allowed to practice. It was no income, and our income, my father as an employee of Jewish community stopped having income, and all we became scavengering for food, which means I had to do all kinds of stuff. I can here say a few words about those psychologists. The Germans were trying very hard, or they paid or supported psychologists working on the way how to get peacefully without resistance Jews to, they call it labor camps, but they were eventually death camps, where they were able in one facility kill 10 to 20,000 people a day and burn their bodies to ashes and put their ashes into bags, marked fertilizers, and sent to German farmers to use it to fertilize their lands in Germany. Which means that nobody knew about the technology or those things, but my mother was able to observe how in practice politicians were putting into practice those results, those PhD psychologists making PhD, how to deceive the Jews to enter those cattle cars and being relocated to so-called labor camps. And we didn't know how they would kill us, but my mother simply knew that they would kill us. Psychologists also worked out how to catch people who resisted or who were able to manage documents, false documents, and live under the names, under so-called Aryan names, non-Jewish names, because people at that time became very scared, anxious, uncertain, and they even instructed police or secret police or observers to find people on the street or, with some anxiety on their faces and to look at their documents and to interrogate them and find out whether or not they are not Jewish or people, or political opponents who were hiding and so on. Which means that it was, we were prepared much better than other people. We knew that they tried to kill us, and we were just didn't know how they would do it. But I don't know how my parents found out, but we knew even of the very sophisticated ways how they would, through propaganda, convince people, calm down, simply remove their doubts, remove their reason to be scared or to be uncertain, and they just played the game in a way that their victims would not guess, would not even know that they are targeted to be really murdered. Not only wiped out, not only robbed, but also murdered. And not only murdered by people of that level of age, of like military age or so, but murder totally. Babies, old people, female, male, regardless of their social status, of their education, of their backgrounds. And there were a lot of Christians, Protestants and Catholics, who had four Jewish grandparents because they converted. Their grandparents converted, but they were born Jewish. They went to parishes, found out birth certificates, and proclaimed them Jewish, shipped them away and killed them because they wanted to confiscate as much property as they could and steal it from them. And this, the purpose of the whole exercise was practically either robbery by conviction, by law, they passed the law, proclaiming a person unwanted or undesirable, or what was called armed robbery. They forced people, like my grandparents didn't want to move their houses, and they were so popular in the town there wasn't not a single person who would force my grandparents out of their homes, which means they called people from another city, militiamen, it's called Linkergarten. They came and did the job because they were hired as killers or as violent people, as people who were paid for robbing and so on, which means that they did the job and they forced them into cattle cars and shipped them, which means that this was some kind of a background. And now a question would be, how come you were not deported? How come you avoided deportation? And how come all the others didn't believe that such a thing might have happened at the end of the trip by train? And how come you decided not to enter those cattle cars, to be relocated into some kind of a community run by your own management and labor camp where you would work manually? They didn't know lawyers and teachers, but manual work would be, and you would feed your families and so on, and little babies and children. The answer, the story is this. In 1942, almost all people were already deported because they were like waves. They filled 1,000 or 2,000 people in one train. They collected the cattle cars on the railroad. But we had two reasons not to be deported in the first wave. Number one was that my father was a clergyman. He was something like a rabbi in America or Canada. And his profession was called Kantor Chazan, like singing or performing religious duties, reading the Torah scroll on Shabbat and holidays, and taking care of kosher food. He was also a shochet, which means a ritual slaughter of animals and so on, and education. Because he spoke Hebrew, even Arabic, because he lived in a holy land at that time, before, which means that they were very valuable in teaching Hebrew and Jewish culture and so on. Which means that in that position, my father was in charge of officiating Jewish funerals. Because they didn't want to scare population. You know, psychologists worked out that scheme as well. Life went on totally uninterrupted. There were about 2% of Jews living in Europe. If there are 100 people in the room and 2 are missing, very few people would notice it. And this was the situation in Europe. The Jewish population was moved away. People benefited from it because they could, in auctions, buy very cheap properties and businesses, and so on, which means that it was not a great resistance against, public resistance against deportations. And Jews were peaceful people, mostly intellectuals, educated people, businessmen, and they were totally opposed to violence, and they didn't own any arms, they didn't hunt even. Jews don't hunt because hunted animal or shot animal is not kosher, it was not like a food. Fishing was allowed, but not very many people were fishing because it was also a violent sport. You didn't kill the fish, but you took it out of water, and if it died, it wouldn't have died if you didn't take it out of water, which means that Jews were very peaceful, intellectual mostly, and literate, as a very contrast to the population where we lived, which was illiterate, and most people were alcoholics even, which means that it was society very primitive. And it was no industry. In the very high mountains, potatoes, cabbage, very simple. There were not even apples would grow there. It was so high in the mountains that apples made it in about quarter size and never grew into full size fruits. It was so cold, winters very long. Only 10 summer days allowed to grow oat, but wheat, rye would not grow there because it was so. And there were a lot of sheep, cheese, and those water routes or rivers were eventually melted ice from the mountains, and they were just all those trout and very cold water fish in it. Such a small creek was running across that town called Onikubin, where I was born and raised, and I was already 12 at the time when deportation started. I come back to that point that my father was exempt to be deported immediately because life was supposed to be very normal. Based on those psychologies, they didn't want to scare population or produce some kind of a resistance or some kind of a question. Propaganda was saying, you know, you will go and work. Nobody told Jews, you know, we are going to take you to a place and kill you. And even if they said that, you know, people would not believe it anyway. The second thing was that Jewish children were not allowed to enter schools, which means that we got an order from the government to produce a Jewish school. Jewish school was produced. It was a very small town, about 93, about 100 families, Jewish families. And they were just, we made a school, and they were just 24 children between the age of 6 and 14, and they would fit into one room. And because my father had that so-called exempt, not to be deported immediately, my mother became a teacher because she had the highest qualification, and it was a contest. And they decided that my mother should become the teacher of the 24 children. And my brother and I, because we couldn't use any outside help, non-Jewish help, if somebody died, my brother and I were digging the grave and put the body in and just bury the person, and my father officiating. That's why they decided when Jews will not live in the district anymore and nobody would die and need a burial and there will be no children left to teach, then at the end of the year all Jewish population of Slovakia will be deported. And in the last transport, my parents would be, and we, naturally children, would be shipped away and complete that period of Jewish life in that area. Because they were still left some Jews there. For example, in that small town where I was born, it was a county seat. It was not a village made of wooden shacks and, you know, a few animals and horses. By the way, the horses were horses left by Genghis Khan 600 years before. And they were small horses, much smaller than what we see now. And hair on their belly, the hair was hanging down. They were Mongolian horses who survived in those very high mountains. And they are very strong, very resistant. They needed very little food. And they were climbing those mountains on icy hills rather easily. A real big horse would not be able to do that. And the only industry there was logging. They were cutting trees and cutting branches off and pulling those tree trunks into the river, where they, by barges, were bringing them to some people who needed to cut them into boards and construction industry furniture, whatever. which means that this was the only industry. Agriculture was minimum, and a little bit of cheese, because people were not paying our parents. It was no income. They didn't have any money. Everything was confiscated. Then we had to scavenge for food. We were working a few days here, a few days there. It was a gardener and a farmer who gave us some vegetable in summertime. But in wintertime, it was more difficult. But still, we were starving. We really didn't know how to survive. One of those tricks how to get food, what I was doing myself, was it was a little creek, melted snow from the mountains, very cold. I was not allowed to go fishing with line and hook because it was a sport, and the Jews were absolutely unable, or they were just not allowed to sport. If they caught me with a line and hook, they would deport me or arrest me as breaking the law. Which means I went in the middle of the night into that creek and submerged, and with my hands, I knew how that little trout, you know, 6-7 inches, small park, its stream was fairly strong, and they were parking or sleeping or whatever you call, in crevices between rocks on the side or the middle of the stream. And I was able with my hands to feel them, squeeze them, put them into my shirt, and we had at least some protein, something to eat. And I was doing it very often. I knew that it was a prison because it was a small town, 2,000 people, and about 270 Jews or something like that. And I knew that where the prison was, and courthouse, and a few lawyers, and a little hospital, one or two rooms hospital. And it was a county seat where was notary public and judges and a little jail. Once I was fishing like this, and it was in the fall, ice was already floating around me, I heard some noise, some words, somebody talking to me, "Hey boy, come here," and it was they were Polish words and Yiddish words, and I understood that it must be some Jewish thing. I looked up. It was on a rock, a little house with large window, and there were some people, and naturally I was curious. I was 12 and very muscled, and really they called me Mowgli, as an ape from Kipling's book of Jungle. I went to the window and I said, "You know, what do you want? What do you want from me?" And they stuck a hand through the bars and gave me a big gold coin and saying, "We are from Poland. They arrested us here as smugglers. If you get us out of here, you get a fistful of those coins." And naturally, I was interested. I knew that they were Jewish and we were already targeted, persecuted, robbed, and so on, which means that deported. And I ran to my mother, and it was a guy whose wife was Catholic, but he knew how to make alcohol. He had a little distillery, and alcohol was like a hard currency. You couldn't get anything for a bottle of alcohol, because they made alcohol at home and they become blind and dead and so on, which means that good alcohol was a very highly merchandise, which was very highly praised. And he knew how to do it. Naturally, he bribed. I came back to the fistful of coins, he bribed those guards. They cracked the door for a few seconds. Those people ran away. He excused himself that he was, happened an accident. Happened. They got very good pay, well paid. We took them along that creek behind the houses in the middle of the night, and put them in an apartment of Jews who were already deported, and that apartment was sealed, the entrance was sealed by police, like because the content was designed or expected to be sold in auction, and stealing was strictly forbidden, and it was the police who guarded it or secured it. We had a divided apartment. We had an entrance to it through the back, which was invisible. Nobody knew about it. And we put those people into that apartment, and then when they were there and ate something, we asked them why did they escape, and what was the purpose, why they escaped, and what scared them, or why did they decide to leave their homes and so on. And they said, oh, we were in a concentration camp where prisoners were coming, and one was Polish, one was from Belgium, I don't know, the other guys, and they were medical doctors. There were three medical doctors and one was a guard, capo, Jewish guy, but very violent and very strong guy, and even had a gun. And we asked them, how did you get out? And he said, oh, we talked to the locomotive engineer who brought in prisoners, Slovaks from Slovakia, and we asked them to bring us railroad uniforms, and we paid him well because he was regularly coming every few days with those deportees. And he brought those uniforms. We dressed as a railroad engineers, as a train employees, and we took showers and started cleaning the wagons and putting the coal into the locomotive and so on, and Germans let the empty train leave. And when we were on the border between Poland and Slovakia, he said, give me back my uniforms, and they jumped a plane and they were arrested as Polish smugglers. And my mother asked him, why would you escape? What was wrong? Where you? And he said, oh, this was a concentration camp where they were killing mostly Jews coming from all over Europe. And my mother asked me, how was it? My parents are there, my siblings, my sisters, their husbands, and my father said my seven siblings are, married, and my cousins. I listened to the whole conversation. They were, since 1938-9, they were already refugees running from Germany and Austria in all directions, because they started this persecuting Jews before. And my father, my home where we lived, was a kosher food, and whoever cared for kosher food or didn't have any other means went to eat with us. And there were always about 20 people around the table. And they were telling us terrible stories from Germany, Austria, how they were beaten up, burned businesses, burned. In the meantime was Kristallnacht with 98. This was already 42, 4 years later. Which means that we knew enough of horror stories already that we are going to be treated very badly. Anyway, they started telling us, those people who were hiding. They bring those Jews, mostly that time it was mostly Jews, there were no Polish or Russian prisoners yet. But they were also there. But what I remember was mostly because we were Jews and they were killing Jews, which means that I remember that Jewish side of the story. And they said, those people come and they tell them, treat them well, and they tell them, your properties put aside, don't worry, and you came to work and we disinfect you, and they put men on one side and female on the other side and children, and they said, we have to disinfect you because we want you to stay healthy, we'll be working here. the kaze, hair off, you know, to eliminate lice and so on. And the people did not have the slightest idea, not everybody. Some people objected, or but they were taken away. And everything was like they were treated rather nicely, as those psychologists suggested. You know, don't provoke them, don't tell them anything so that they would not resist. And then you have a big problem, because how you handle 1,000 or 2,000 people at a time when they are resisting. The whole thing has been perfectly like directed, like a movie director. And then they got a piece of soap in their hand and asked to remember where they put their clothes and so on. And they were led to, and everything was like they couldn't go back. Back, they were just a pass, a concrete wall, like a tunnel in one direction, and people ended up in a big room with showers hanging from the ceiling, men from one side, female from the other side, and children. And then the door was closed, maybe 1,000 people inside. And instead of having warm showers, they expected, started coming some gas. They started coughing. Some people dropped dead, and in 15 minutes, everybody was dead, and it was a pile of dead bodies. Prisoners came, pulling those bodies out, and cremated them, throwing them into a battery those seems to be very hot furnaces, but where everything metals melted. They put the golden crowns and teeth, you know, like out of their teeth, and the rest. They burned the rest to ashes, and they people are telling us those things like you would describe. You know, I put celery on my pan and put an egg on it and ate it for breakfast. They didn't even show any emotions. And my mother was, I remember asking them, "You don't have to tell us, you know, horror stories. We will help you anyway. You don't have to." To exaggerate and say us things which really are very unlikely and so on. And they said, no, it's really started giving us more and more and more details. And we three children are standing there listening to it. And I remember it very clearly because it was so intense and so life-threatening. And finally, 3 days later, my parents understood that they were not kidding, not asking for some some mercy or some kind of a sympathy or some kind of a favors or so on, that this really was happening there. And we tried to warn other Jews, don't go into those transports. We couldn't tell them, you know, we rescued some witnesses and we know it for sure. Because they would arrest us, you know, so they would leak out that we were part of those so-called Polish smugglers who vanished from prison. If they accused us of it, we might have been hanged or shot. It was a war. In 1941, they attacked Soviet Union, Poland, and so on. The whole Europe, West Europe was taken over, and they were already in North Africa. It was just nowhere to escape, and it was war has a different rules. If you make you transgress during the war, they are not some half a year or a year long court procedures. They just find a wall and they shoot people for treason or for disobeying and for discipline in this and that, which means that people didn't believe us, and we could not support our stories with, you know, evidence of we met those people and we know that it's true. And a lot of people I hear today, you know, how people think to my mother, Frau Spitz, sind Sie meschugge? Are you crazy? Are you crazy? Such a thing. Would Churchill, Roosevelt, or BBC, or Pope, or Stalin say something about killing Jews in a factory style? They would reveal to us, they would warn us. Which means that, and they continue going there. Few people followed it, followed what we were saying, and they took it seriously. And they got false papers, escaped, and some of them we met after the war. By the way, those people who were those Polish smugglers who escaped from Auschwitz, by the way, they were preparing also to wipe out Polish, simply Slavic people as well, and also French, they called degenerate. And because English people were fighting against them, and Roosevelt was, they called him Rosenfeld because he had some Jewish ancestry. they were considering murdering every Anglo-Saxon too, because Anglo-Saxons were real enemies who were opposing Hitler, and Churchill was in charge who preferred the war against Chamberlain, who preferred to surrender and somehow accommodate the Germans. Which means that they didn't trust us, but who trusted us survived, and we, after the war, people came back and thanking us for saving their lives. Those people whom we saved from that prison survived. They went to Hungary. They had a lot of money, obviously, jewelry, whatever. They had a coat which was lined with all gold and diamonds and so on, because they were prepared well. They were medical doctors. Medical doctors were showing us ampules they had on them, cholera, typhoid. They would have wiped out the Russians and Polish with those diseases, biological weapons. They were well prepared to wipe out the millions of people that way, because they didn't have enough bullets and they didn't have enough gas chambers to wipe out 100 million or I don't know how many Russians, or 30, 40 million Polish and so on, and Serbs and simply black people they would have wiped out very quickly, and actually Oriental people would come after because they didn't have any other plans than to repopulate this planet with a so-called German race. They had farms already in Poland where SS and officers, they rewarded them for their bravery, and they could sleep with German girls who had offsprings, and there were 20,000 kids dedicated to repopulate Slavic areas, and they had to either sterilize the population, Poles and Russians, so they wouldn't have kids, and killed older people, starved them, and so on. They killed about 20 to 27 million Russians. They were not only Russians, but all those Soviet nationalities. And Ukrainians were very happy to escape Stalin's terror, because he killed 3 or 4 million of them, starved them to death. Which means that they were very happy to have a liberator in the form of Nazi army, German army, and they quickly turned around, and Germans started killing Ukrainians because they were the Slavic people. And then naturally partisans and so on developed. They were fighting next to the Soviets to fighting, but they also were some collaborators with Nazi Germany. I don't remember any Soviet or Russians who would have an army, a Nazi army, but Ukrainian army, Ukrainians were recruited into the army. It was a General Bandera, they called it the Bandera Army, which was in German uniforms and fighting Soviets fighting Americans or French and British who resisted Hitler. Anyway, those people, those doctors survived. We gave them maps to avoid roads, main roads, where we knew where those those posts where they stopped people asking for papers. And through mountains they made it to Germany, they returned to Belgium. And when my brother was very ill, they were sending us prednisone. I remember even the name of the medication. It was cortisone, which was reducing swellings caused by, you know, like Hodgkin disease is my symptom is growing glands, like cancerous growth of glands, which press on nerves and it's terribly painful. And it helped my brother to, instead of 2 years, to live 6 years. And a lot of art he produced in those years. Without the medication, he would not be able to. What we did after finding out what we were supposed to go, my mother called her three children. You know, my brother was 14, I was 12, my sister 10. And she told us, you know, the whole world, huge army, every government of Europe, thousands of miles in all directions, we have nowhere to run. We are sentenced to death. We have a choice to take a poison and decide on our own destiny, or to fight against all odds, because the odds are absolutely against us. You know, to survive, secret police, laws of the country, soldiers, Slovaks, fascists, Germans, you know how it is going to be a very, very, very difficult thing. Do you want to fight a battle which is very unlikely, or you want to take poison, stay in bed and never wake up? And we didn't hesitate a second. We said, if we are going to fight and stay alive, we are not going to give up. My mother said, okay, I'm going to try to save my family. My father was religious, and he said, you know, if God wants us to die, let's go and die. God has a plan, and we might become martyrs, and he might said, help the next generation also. And he just did not want to use any violence or any resistance. And he said, God will help us, or God will decide. And my mother said, no, God is not going to not decide. God didn't decide to kill us. It was Hitler who decided to kill us. It was a Tiso, president of our country, fascist, a murderer who is sending to certain deaths his citizens. And God is giving us all our intelligence, all forces, all the possibilities. We are healthy, with healthy mind and senses, and God is going to help us to resist and to survive. And we decided on the spot if they decided to push us into the cattle cars, we would never ever enter it, even at the price that they would shoot us at the railroad in front of those. Which means that this was a determination somewhere in the fall of 1942. The deportation was supposed to end up at the end of the year, where no Jews would live in the territory anymore. However, German army was stopped at Stalingrad and in Moscow. 300,000 elite soldiers who were spear of the German army and took over Soviet Union in their tanks and fast-moving vehicles and mortars and cannons and machine guns, something they wanted to do it recently, but they failed because some partisans shot the gas supplies and food supplies, and the poor guys, 40 miles long tank, you know, stopped, and they still slowed down. But, you know, I should not have said that because it doesn't belong to this story. But anyway, at the end of 1942, the German army stopped being so incredibly successful that they had all Europe. They stopped at Moscow and Stalingrad, and they were already in North Africa. Which means that Slovak fascists started thinking over, for good heavens, we are on the wrong side. They were all opportunists. They were all thieves, bandits, gangsters who took over government and joined the Nazis, who were nothing else, robbers and murderers. And somehow, at the beginning of 1943, there were no more deportations. There were politicians who tried to restart, you know, deportations and kick out about 12,000 Jews who still remained out of about 100,000 in the country because they were in a small town, for example, where I came from. They were piping. It was piping. It was really drinking water. There were some waste sinks. There were some electrical lines, and it was a plumber, Jewish plumber, who knew all those lines. And if something went wrong, there would be no water, there would be no electricity, there would be no air, there would be no this and that. It was a Jewish pharmacist. If they shipped him away, it would be no medication. You know, people might be dying of diseases. And so on, which means that they were in the country still left, small country, a few million people. They were still left about 12,000 people, and few people even in the town where we lived. And to keep the situation like normal, they kept even our rabbi alive. In 1943, we somehow survived. Becoming invisible, becoming unimportant, and simply scavengering and simply working for a little reward, like in summertime or spring, between spring and fall, for gardener who gave us vegetables he couldn't sell, some, you know, faulty things, which, you know, like, and we scavengered, you know, little fish and so on. Which means that it was a survival, and it was a survival, one of those things, how we survived the year, made me a hugger. And I tell you this story because it's very important. It was very hilly, very icy all year long, and people were sleeping, and the only industry, real industry, was logging. And taking those logs downhill on the icy slopes, and a lot of people were injured by cutting the branches or sliding down that wood. And it was they dislocated their joints and broken bones and so on. And the same thing was happening to sheep and goats and cows and horses. They were slipping on the ice and dislocating joints, and what they did. You know, people shot them or killed them with hatchets and used the meat. My father, it was a Jewish chiropractor, his name was Klein, and he said, every day I heal about 30 people from those injuries. They would never deport me, you know, it would be a revolution. Naturally, those Meshulish shaman came at night and shipped him, pushed him into a cattle car, and he was not there anymore. And people needed that service. But my father was fascinated by seeing, you know, like people, crippled people, walked into his office, and in a few minutes they walked out healthy because he was able to put the joints back into. And people who were crippled could walk and could move their limbs and so on. And he was just totally admiring this guy. And when he vanished in 1942, my father said, you know, I learned enough of watching him, and then he let me try some. He told me, you know, hide your star, put some coat over it, put your hat on your over your eyes so that nobody would recognize you, and let's go to the villages. And we went to the village surrounding villages, and said, if you have a sheep or a goat or a horse or a cow with dislocated joints or broken bones, we can fix it, and you don't have to kill it and eat it as meat. And some people said, okay, I have a sheep, it's just you know, crippled, and we fixed it. And the goat, and the horse. Horse was very important, you know. When the horse died, the family died. When a cow died, family might die because it was no milk and no cheese, and which means that we fixed few animals, and the word spread very quickly. That guy can. We were doing it for a few months, and we got few eggs or a piece of butter or bread and so on. And this was a very important part of our diet. And our people already, they didn't know we were Jewish. And those who knew didn't tell, because medical doctors were very hostile against what we were doing. And veterinarians, because we were stealing their jobs. Anyway, some people came and say, if you can fix a goat, I'm crippled, my shoulder is dislocated, I'm, you know, I cannot walk, can you try to fix me? And my father said, you have to swear at the, you know, life of your mother or something, or religious, to Jesus, that you don't tell anybody, because if you tell somebody, we will be deported, or they might arrest us. You know, the medical doctors were very harsh against those chiropractors. It was illegal healing. And naturally, they were swearing, and we were fixing them. And if we fixed a human being, we even got a chicken for it. Imagine 1 week, another week of life, which means that this was an incredible source of survival. And things like that, inventing things which people needed, serving them, and in all secrecy. And then it came, then, you know, Soviets were sending parachuted political people into the territory to fight the fascists and to fight the German and fight the occupation because of war. Soviets started pushing from Moscow and Stalingrad towards the West. And it was one battle after the other, and all the battles were proclaimed as great German victory. We did not allow to destroy our army between, I don't know, Kharkov and Lviv, because, you know, we were so skillful to retreat, but we reinterpreted it in a different way. They are running, running from the east to the west. And they were, we had even a map, you know, not too many people knew how to read a map, to see how they were gradually, you know, we knew the town where they were. And it was like between Stalingrad and Poland, there were a lot of spots. And they were always winning to retreat successfully. And it was a defeat of German army, which means that Slovak fascists, and the communists were mostly murdered by the Nazis, the Gestapo, and SS, which means that they were asking us to help them with languages, with listening to BBC, printing leaflets, and so on, which means that it was only, my brother was an artist, since he was really 12 years old, he decided to become an artist. He was able to make those leaflets, and my sister, in a milk can, you know, she was small, she was 10 years old, she was distributing those leaflets in a milk can, walking around, and so on. Which means that they needed us, the underground needed us, and Slovak fascists were not as harsh and as they were some. But anyway, it was a situation which we had to survive somehow, and we were lucky to do that. Some people escaped to Hungary, but in 1944, even Hungarian Jews started being shipped to those, and they didn't know they go to their death. Anyway, in 1944, situation became so bad for Germans and for Slovak fascists that part of the army revolted and made something called Slovak National Uprising. It only lasted a week or two, but still, it was showing the loyalty was turning around. Soviet army, that time it was called the Red Army, was already in Poland and Ukraine. And we were so high in the mountains that we could hear bombardments, you know, if the airplane was dropping bombs, we heard, ooh, 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 and it was very clear in the high mountains to hear what was going on in the valleys. Then we started hearing bum, bum, which was a cannon. Cannon would produce a sound when it shot, and when the bullet or the cartridge falls down, it explodes again, and it's a two, bum, bum. Then it was a machine gun, da ta 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 ta. It was a mortar, was also like milder, but it was, which means that we learn to distinguish different weapons. And it started with a bombardment. We heard it, ooh, 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 in night particularly. Which means that in 1944, the front line was moving closer. The uprising was very quickly crushed. German army took over Slovakia, the whole Slovakia, and population, because what they did mostly to occupy the country was a truck with a mortar in the truck area, shooting those mortars ahead about, I don't know, 100 feet or something, or maybe 200 feet, and on the top of the truck, on the top of the driver's seat was a machine gun, and a guy was machine gun, anything which moved. Which means that, and where a mortar fell in a house, it started burning, and explosion broke the glass. Which means that civilian population was scared to death, and they ran into the streets which were off the road, into the villages of the road, and some who had some political uncertainties or were communists or Jews were running into small villages or mountains to survive, you know, that war situation. It was a war situation. Which means that they didn't distinguish between races, religions, or young or old. You know, war is a war, and they were taking over the country and bombarding with airplanes. They were bombarding some important military posts where they knew that those guerrillas, partisans, or whatever I call them, were having some important gatherings. Which means that during those times, what we did when the German army approached those mountains, the town where we lived, we just removed the stars. We saw people running. We took our backpacks and tightened our shoes because we were sleeping with just untied shoes, dressed. We never undressed. We didn't even have second pair of underwear or what we were wearing, because everything was confiscated, stolen from us. And we had a backpack. My mother prepared, you know, she was taking sliced bread and we had one sink in our apartment, which was a stove, like made of bricks, which nobody could steal that. The furniture, everything was, almost every furniture was gone. Few pieces left. Anyway, we were making toast on a metal plate, you know, wooden kitchen stove, made brick stove, and we put it in a bag. Then we had a little bit of sugar, some almonds, because the fascist government was friendly with Spain, with Franco, and there were some even few boxes of sardines and almonds and raisins and sugar and that bread which we toasted so that it wouldn't get fungus, and we had backpacks. We were three children, two adults, and our grandfather who came living with us. He came in 1942 home, and his apartment was sealed, and it was a big sign on the door saying people who lived here were deported, which means that he went to his children. He had seven children in the same town living, and he went to each of them, and each had a sign on the door, people from this apartment were deported, which means that he removed his star, because Jews were not allowed to travel by train. He removed his star and traveled to his son, who he knew was not deported, because we corresponded, and he came suddenly saying, you know, I couldn't go home, I couldn't go to my children, I'm here, and I'm going to live with you. And he survived the war with us. But how we survived the war? We ran to my mountains, and we walked 2 hours, two days, with sleeping with in a, you know, there were about 100 sheep, and we went there, and I've never seen fleas as big as we got that night from those sheep. And anyway, in the morning we continued until we hit a small village. There were only 9 houses there. And there were a lot of refugees. There were 9 houses, but there might have been 100 people already there hiding, so-called hiding. And we found a house of a guy. He originally, we didn't know that time, but he killed his wife, I don't know why. And he spent, I don't know, 20 years in prison. And now he lived in the little house, one-room house. He was sleeping at one corner of the one-room house, and on the other side was his little horse, who he used for some work. Or he had a little piece of land or whatever. And he moved to his horse, and he rented us the other half. And new refugees came, and we shared that space, that half a room, with another family and another family. But anyway, it was September harvest time. We were helping peasants with the harvest. But everybody was waiting until the war situation settles and they can go home. Those political people did not go home because SS and Gestapo already took over and they knew they would be killed, which means that they had camps and they had villages and they had organizations. But we were few Jews. Our rabbi also ran into that village, and we were telling him, come, we are building a shelter in the mountains underground, and we are going to wait out the end of the war, because we believed that, you know, we already heard bombardments. It was not further than probably 100 miles from Ukraine, in Ukraine, and 100 miles into Poland. I said, how many more weeks they need to approach us and take over our area? we did not believe that it would take longer than a few weeks. And he said, no, I'm old, and I go home and let God decide what to do with me and so on. Which means that he went back, and Germans put a big posters on the streets that people come back, nothing will happen to you, you did nothing, you are civilians and so on. And if you are Jews among you, you survived so far, we would not touch you, you can come home and so on. Which means that some Jews came back, naturally they grabbed them and they deported them, put them in the cattle cars. Poland was already gone, which means that they were shipped to Germany. And we had one interesting case, because after the war, a person who we knew, he was disappointed with Judaism, converted to Catholic faith, and took a seminary education and became a Catholic priest. And he was our family friend, you know, like my father was clergyman in this religion, he was in that religion, and we were friends with his parents, with him, and so on. That when the Gestapo came back, they took him. He was in his priestly uniform, you know, that robe, and he was in the same cattle car with our rabbi. His name was Friedman, and the same rabbi who disappointed him when he was a teenager. He was very strict, I don't know what was the conflict, and he came back after the war telling us all this story. They went towards Sachsenhausen. He said, you know, I took a registration card from Sachsenhausen office, and it was written Edmund Bartosz, this was his name. Religion, Jewish, profession, Catholic priest. And we had a very good laugh, you know, after the war, he had a good laugh. And he remained priest in a communist country. But he said, you know, I was in a cattle car and with a rabbi who had his head on my knees where he died, because he was very fragile and very, you know, like malnutrition and so on. And probably even his mind was, he gave up. And he said, those few days in the cattle car with Rabbi, he finally understood Judaism. He said, I would have never converted if I knew Judaism. And the Rabbi dying there, it might have been 70, 75, something like that. I would have never converted, but in a communist country, he produced some kind of I wouldn't say kolkhoz or something like that, but he started making cheese and salamis, and people loved him, our Jewish priest, and they made capitalism like an island within a communist system. They became rich and simply producing food was 90% of income people spend on food, because agriculture was destroyed by kolkhozes and by those try to industrialize agriculture. Now, anyway, this was one of those things. While those people were preparing to return home, we found a place in the forest where it was a little creek, there was a little creek between two very steep slopes, and they were about 1 to 2 feet depending on moisture, depending on rain, water, and we dug out a deep, we cut a triangle into the side of the hill. You know, that yellow part. And in the triangle we put wooden skeleton, crisscrossed it, and then it ended up in a situation that it was all camouflaged. We were breathing through the hole in the roof, a hollow stump, and it was like in all four, we had to walk in and out with about 1 foot or foot and a half opening on the bottom over that little water here, so that we can take water out of, we can, whatever came out of us, it would be flushed away, and we had fresh water all the time. We believed that in a few weeks, and this, and later on, we moved into the shelter. We had a bag, half a bag of potatoes, little bit of flour, and believing that in a few weeks we will be liberated, because the front line was very close, and we heard the bombardment already. Unfortunately, the front line stopped, and they couldn't get through the border. Ukraine, 70,000 people were machine gunned by trying to cross very narrow pass, which means that the Soviets had to surround Slovakia, and Germans ran away in one day, south, north, east, west, ran away April 4. It was a day when all Slovakia was practically liberated from the one corner to the other one, because the Germans gave up it. They were already surrounded from three sides. And through that opening, in 1 month, the war was over. Problem was that we were there in that hole, which we believed would last about maybe a month maximum. We had to spend 200 days, which is a huge amount of time. Snow fell. They were searching for us. Let me go back how we got the idea of the shelter. My brother was a very good artist, a very sensitive person, and very smart. He was a genius, even if they say that brother said about brother's a genius, it might be a little bit exaggerated. This was not exaggerated. He was a real genius, because he sat in a piano and started composing music when he was 4 or 5 years old. He wanted to speak French. He took a book, French exercise book, read it from cover to cover, and started speaking French. You know, it's a normal problem. I was absolutely next to him, like a very primitive peasant boy with no education. I have some talents, but certainly couldn't reach his. When they robbed us of everything, and we had nothing except that kitchen stove and charcoal in it, he started thinking of a shelter under the ground, because he said, you know, we cannot live underwater like fish. We cannot fly in the air, even if we have a glider or an airplane. It was a war that we will shut down. We don't have money to buy those false papers, IDs, and so on, because everybody knew us. You know, I was born there, a schoolmate, which means that we couldn't hide. Which means the only way out is to live like animals in a forest. Deer survive winters, or survive in a forest. Wolves and snakes and bear, there were a lot of bear, survive in a forest, which means that this is the only way out. And he started the charcoal out of the stove, designing on the wall, because we didn't have any paper or pencils. And so, which means that after we escaped, SS German soldiers lived in that apartment, and they saw how those Jews are trying to outsmart us, and they saw the design, you know, like where to get in air intake, how to get, and they went to villages and they interrogated people, because most Jews were shipped to those concentration camps, few young people survived, but very few. And they were sending those patrols on horses to find us, because they didn't want to have witnesses of their crime and of history of that, which means that this was a very tough situation, because they really tried to find us and kill us. On the other hand, they were partisans in the forest who didn't like Jews either. They were Ukrainians parachuted into the forest to fight the Nazis, and they found us, and they stripped us into I escaped, naturally, because I was a bandit. I wanted to kill the guy and take his weapon and shoot the others who were inside of a shelter going through our stuff, trying to find jewelry or money or whatever. And I told, whispered my mother, they lined us up. I told my mother, you know, I go behind him, I had a hatchet always behind my belt as a bandit. And I said, I go behind him, he had a canvas hat, like a soldier, Soviet soldier. And I go behind him, split his head, take his weapon, and shoot the others who were inside of the shelter. They walked in. And my mother said, you know how to shoot that weapon. We were whispering, you know, like one was guarding us and the others were robbing us. And I said, I don't know, I figured it out. Mother said, figure it out? Okay, figure out. You probably would not. I was 14. My mother said, you know, leave it to me. I would do it. Let me handle it. Since I found a nice spot where I could escape, and then they came out, those guys, and said, okay, tell us your last wish, because we are going to shoot you. Give us dollars and gold. And my mother or father said, you know, gold and dollars, we had no gold and dollars, we don't have no money. You know, the war was long, and we don't have anything like that. Jews always have. Which means that we are going to shoot you. And what is your last wish? Which means my father said, let us pray. And they put a tefillin on and talis, and because Jews are buried in that way, and said, okay, shoot. Don't torture us here. Take it, you know, get over with it. And my mother started shouting, why would you kill my children? What did we do to you? What did I do to you? We are not your enemies. Because they spoke Ukrainian, a Slovak Ukrainian, it was very easy. My mother spoke some Russian. And they just said, okay, they started laughing, you know. And when they lifted their weapons, I jumped over and started zigzagging through the forest and ran away. But all the others slid down to the middle, and I found out later. I went to the partisans, it was my friend, and I said, give me a gun. I would follow them in the snow. They killed my family, because I believe that the shooting after me, they were shooting at them too. And my friend, you know, I said, I must have looked like a 10-year-old child. I can do nothing for you. I don't have enough weapons. I don't give you any. I wanted to have a handgun. But I would follow them and shoot them. They would have killed me very quickly anyway. But anyway, I was naive. I didn't know too much about it. Then he said, I can put you in my partisan unit. And he said, was one of them mustache, and one of them had a scarf here, one of them had a shielded hat, and I understood that he knew them. And when I understood that they were really not, they were saying, we are Bender Army. We are Benderovci. They were not regular partisans, but they were anti-Semitic gangsters. But they were fighting, were sent to fight Germans. Anyway, he said, okay, go sleep in a hay. You know, they had hay under the roof, in the attic. And I said, okay, in the morning I report to you, partisan. I knew that in the morning this guy would would shoot me on the spot to get, you know, hear of me before. Which means that they would tell him, you know, there's a guy who escaped from the forest, and I'd be gone. Which means that I said, okay, I'm going to sleep in the hay, and in the morning I report to you. And when they fell asleep, because it was at night, I climbed down and ran back to the forest to bury them. I believe that they were all shot. And they were alive, but men in underwear, standing in snow. And it was February. We had to survive till April. Anyway, we didn't know what to do, because they left, but took our backpacks, our blankets, all food, even if they were berries and mushrooms and things like that you find in a forest. Even they wanted to starve us and freeze us, you know, died of frost. It was terribly cold year. Or if we walked to the forest, to the village, a patrol would shoot us, because they would see people, you know, like refugees or simply Jews were recognized. Which means it was life sentence. We were thinking of, you know, you escaped, and they might come back and get us later. But they did not even think that we would survive such a thing, like being without undress. I was very small. My dress wouldn't fit. My grandfather was tall. My father much taller than I, and my brother as well. Which means that nothing what I was wearing, 3 layers, would fit them. And I had also those felt, you know, like felt dress, so that I would not freeze. Anyway, it ended up that we decided to go back to the shelter, because it was the only way to survive. It started snowing, and the footsteps were gone, because they were shooting. Patrols, Germans have heard the shooting, and they might have followed footsteps. But it started snowing, which means that they would, first of all, they wouldn't find parties, those parties, and guerrillas would not find the place where we were. Germans would not find it, because it was shooting somewhere, and the Jews don't shoot. No, but it means that they would be scared of them anyway. We could return back, and I sometimes talk to schools where there are no Jews. I said, if you ever a Catholic, you will be looking at a saint. And they say, how come? They say, a miracle happened. It was an area where we're about 15 miles in all 4 directions, there's spa. Spa with mineral water, hot mineral water, like sulfur smelling, like rotten egg smelling, sulfur, hydrosulfide. And it is healing on the one hand, because it kills bacteria and fungus, and on the other hand, a larger amount can kill you. And it has a hallucination effect. You know, it's a drug. It's a poison, which means that when it reaches the brain, you start, you know, like dreaming. That night, when we needed it, we were disturbing the ground, the dirt, cutting, you know, deep. A mineral water, that smelling, sulfur-smelling water, erupted from the bottom of the shelter and started flowing into the little water stream a few feet from us. And it heated up the hole, and it produced that hallucinating effect, and we spent 2 more months alive in that. I had tuberculosis after the war. Each of us had something, but it healed in 2 months. I was healed because they shot few calcium injections and the hole closed down, which means the Canadians, when we escaped, didn't find out 20 years later any traces even of it, the same Americans, because they have to be healthy to move it to those 2 countries. Anyway, we survived it and lived there till April 4, when five times the war in that forest, people battling man against man in the forest, where craters of cannon shells exploding, you know, a few yards from our shelter, and if something fell on our roof, it would have collapsed and killed us. If we escaped, either army would have killed us because of shooting each other in the forest. And five times, because it was a distillery in that town where I came from, and the Soviet army, Red Army at the time, found out the distillery, they got all drunk, Germans came back, killed them, but they knew that the war was really close to the end, and they were losing from Moscow to Slovakia, was a long way. And they knew that it is, you know, if the Russians get them, they would shoot them because they were traitors, you know, Hungarians and Romanians and all kinds of Slovaks, which means that they were desperate people. They got drunk in the distillery as well. And Russians came back and killed them, and it was that back five times over our head, you know, like fighting and then peace, and then back from left to right, the noise, and from right to left, the noise. And we were inside, not going out, you know, not eating anything, not even, you know, sucking the ice or snow, what was usually we did some, you know, something going through our bodies. Then it was silence, but we didn't know if it was going to return or not. And suddenly we heard in Slovak language people, like voices saying, We know you are somewhere here. If you are alive, war is over. You can come out. But we didn't trust them because it is many times like those people on horsebacks were saying, you know, help, help, but people looked back, and it was the end of it. She said we were ready for that too. But my master recognized them, you know. We put a tree into the hole through which we walked in and out, and between the branches, my master recognized those peasants where we spent a few weeks. And that way we crawled out, and they brought us some bread and some water in a jug, and told us, you know, there are mines on the left and mines on the right. mines laid by Germans, and there are mines laid by partisans, guerrillas. Which means that, you know, like, if we don't show you the path in between or the head of points, you might blow up. Come with us. Why we couldn't walk? Which means that we ate something, you know, a piece of bread. We were very poor there. And the war, and a few hours later, or simply I don't remember, we didn't have any watches and we didn't know any. We were almost blind because it was just such a long time in darkness. And finally we left, and we went downhill, and my mother was hitting the ground. She didn't want me to do it. In case it is a mine, it would explode, kill probably the first person. And we went like geese, one after the other, in a row. And my mother said, I lived already, you didn't. I'm not going to let you die. Which means that we were hitting the ground, making alive that little village, and then recovering somehow, or got something, you know, like washed ourselves and so on. And then moved to about 5 kilometers, 2 miles to the town where I was born. It was a not anymore a tiny village, but it was. And what was very strange, we got some help. There were some Jewish people among the Red Army who helped us. Mostly they wanted to alcohol. We arranged giving them alcohol, and they gave us whatever. I even got a gun for one. I was carrying a gun with two bullets. Because you never know if somebody was try to kill you, because there were witnesses of the robberies, of the people who wanted to send us to the our death. But they mostly ran away with German army. Anyway, and we were able to communicate with Ukrainian and Russians, and you know, they were mostly, the area where we lived was liberated by army of General Malinovsky. And they were Siberian prisoners. They were offered few, you know, they killed somebody or robbed somebody or whatever. And they were offered each medal, you know, like would be 5 years less prison and so on. Which means that they were criminals, professional criminals. And those people liberated our area. I went back to where we lived before. No, by the way, they gave us an apartment because lots of people ran away, those fascists. And they apologized, you know, in one corner water was leaking into the apartment and there were some mushrooms growing in one corner. You know, don't get offended because it... We started laughing, you know, started spending 7 months in a clay and fungus covered hole in a forest, few mushrooms in the corner, beautiful roof and with running water. You know, it was like a Gan Eden, like a paradise, like a castle or some kind of a you know, incredible conditions. Now anyway, there were some people in the Soviet army who needed civilian clothes because they wanted probably to run away. They didn't want to end up in a gulag or something, which means that we helped them too. And the Soviet Jews helped us in a very interesting way because we looked terribly. We looked like skeletons and we were all sick. Anyway, we saw then, I remember I went with my father, the streets were full of trucks and tanks and cannons, you know, pulling cannons. And everywhere in Azbuka, toward Berlin, we are going toward Berlin, because it was only Czech Republic and then Germany. Which means that it was probably, I don't know, a few hundred miles, and it could have been reached in a day, but it took till May, another month, to reach it, to get to Berlin and find burned bodies of those Nazi leaders. But anyway, we went with my father, already dressed in something and washed. And we saw a guy in my father's pajamas, because we had several layers of dress, and pajamas underneath, so that several layers to survive that winter when we escaped. And we saw in my father's pajamas, I don't know, his Polkovnik Ivanov. He was in charge of that whole area, and he was a partisan who robbed us. It was him parading in my father's pajamas, like in Kurort, as he was in Sochi somewhere. So, you know, it was so primitive, they asked people, give me a watch. And the following day, say, that watch stops. You have to wind it. They didn't know. You gave me a wrong watch and killed him. Now, me had a friend who survived Holocaust, Jewish boy, who refused to give them his watch, and they shot him dead. And after surviving 5 years, they killed him because he didn't give them, but it was in Bratislava. Anyway, it means that, you know, they were, I would estimate 1,000 different ways of being killed, which we avoided, which means that it was a miracle by itself, because statistically it doesn't make any sense. But mother was psychic, I was psychic. We guessed, my mother had dreams of her parents pushing pushing this, doing that. And my mother, we were whispering as at home. And my mother saying, you know, I had a strange dream that my mother was standing in front of the shelter doing this. What does it mean? We a night came and we looked out, because we came out, and we saw horseshoes about 5 yards from our shelter, you know, in that, and they started sliding on ice. And they just, horses refused to go there. If they went a little further, they would end up on the roof, and it would be very probably our end. And they stopped a few yards from there, and my mother had a dream like her mother was pushing something away. Which means that I had the rational engineering mind, but I understood that it is such a thing as telepathy, clairvoyance, that communications are called non-verbal communication. I started having those visions, and they were telling me what I should do and how to survive it and so on, and this will be in that movie in 3 weeks. Which means that I communicated with somebody something, but it was not, my eyes were closed and I didn't make a sound, and it still was a communication. And we debated, we talked, and it was not once, twice or three times, it was hundreds of times. And I believe that everybody has that. I was 14, I didn't get any education for 5 years, it was very primitive, I had no information about psychic powers and this power and that power, about ability to use my senses or capacity of my senses and so on. And later in life, when we escaped from a communist country and ended up in a democracy, people started asking me those questions, you know, like, what did you... And started looking through books, you know, Buddhist, Hindus, Christian, Jewish, Kabbalah, and they asked me, can you share with us, because you know something nobody knows. And I started giving lectures, and I even published something about it, which means that it was a course of 2 hours each, 7 times, 14 hours, and I have the documented, I have posters here, and I have some of them online. What I learned, and there are, like Shakespeare said, many things between heaven and earth we have no idea about. Our eye can see 1%, our ear can hear 1% of possible vibrations and sounds. A dog can hear more, a bat has a radar, we have nothing like that. But some of us have a little larger scale. No, usually when I talk to people, somebody might be sitting on the chair here, but he's not made of stuff we are made of. He might be less dense, because I can feel that you are, I can feel that you exist. But if it is some kind of a, like a different material which is intelligent, holds together, which is in a dimension which is beyond my ability to see, because my eye can only see certain part of the spectrum or hear, which means that if I have the ability to see more of the spectrum than human beings in general or average person has, then he knows more about ESP, which is extrasensory perceptions, or nonverbal communications, or some kind of a talent or genius and this and that. You know, Mozart was composing music as a little as a child. Where did he get it? You know, it was an ability which anybody else around him didn't have. I started telling people how to think, what to do, how to live, because I was told how to do it and I survived impossible situations. And this is what I share with people, and I suggest everybody keep smiling. You know, first 100 years are the worst, but it doesn't get better. You have to get used to it. Music. Live life. Love everybody. Hug everybody. How to heal those animals and humans. Now I hug people and they say, I feel so good after being hugged. I healed them. I fix their joints and I fix their muscles or bones and so on. And they feel great. And they don't even know what I did. And it's part of the fixing goats and horses. Goats I have for different reasons. I lived in those mountains. Mm-hmm. If you take a sheep and put it in a, bring it into the forest, 3 days later, sheep is dead. If you take a cow and do the same thing, the cow would not survive. You take a goat and put it in a forest, and in a few years, there will be 50 goats. They would live. Goat cheese or goat milk is healing, is extremely healthy compared to sheep or cow milk. They are degenerated, made to serve humans. But God refused to be slave to human race. for a bear would kill it.